Chapter 16. The Execution. The sun was already setting over Bald Mountain, and this mountain was surrounded by a double cordon. The cavalry ailer that cut through the procurator's path around midday trotted out to the city's Hebron Gate. A path had already been cleared for it. The infantrymen of the Cappadocian cohort had pushed aside the masses of people, mules and camels, raising white pillars of dust to the sky as it trotted. The ailer came to an intersection of two roads, one leading south to Bethlehem and the other northwest to Jaffa. The ailer flew off down the northwest road. The same Cappadocians were strung out along the side of the road, having already chased aside all the caravans hurrying to the festival in Yerushalayim. Leaving their temporary striped tents that were pitched right on the grass, crowds of pilgrims stood behind the Cappadocians. After about a mile, the ailer overtook the second cohort of the Lightning Legion, and after another mile was the first to arrive at the foot of Bald Mountain. Here, it dismounted, the commander separated the ailer into squads, and they cordoned off the entire foot of the low hill, leaving only one approach from the Jaffa Road free. Some time later, the second cohort reached the hill, ascended to the next tier, and encircled the top in a wreath. Last came the sentry commanded by Mark the Ratslayer, walking in two lines along the edges of the road. In between the lines, convoyed by the secret guard, rode a cart containing the three condemned men with white boards hanging from their necks. Each board contained the inscription, "Robber and Mutineer," in both Aramaic and Greek. The first cart was followed by others, loaded with freshly chopped posts, with crossbars, ropes, shovels, buckets, and axes. Six executioners rode on these carts. Behind them, on horseback, rode Mark the Centurion, the head of Yerushalayim's temple guard, and the same hooded man that Pilate had conferred with briefly in a darkened room of the palace. A line of soldiers brought up the rear of the procession. Only then came approximately 2,000 gapers, who were braving the hellish heat to observe the interesting spectacle. The gapers from the city were now being joined by curious pilgrims, who were given unrestricted access to the tail of the procession. To the shrill yells of criers accompanying the column and broadcasting what Pilate had shouted at noon, the procession pulled on to Bald Mountain. The ailer allowed everyone onto the second level, while the second sentry only admitted those who had a part in the execution to the very top. Then, manoeuvring quickly, the sentry spread the crowd all around the hill, positioning the people between the infantry cordon above and the cavalry cordon below. They could now witness the execution through the sparse chain of infantrymen. And so, over 3 hours had passed since the procession ascended the mountain. The sun was already setting over Bald Mountain, but the heat was still unbearable. The soldiers in both cordons suffered from heat and boredom, inwardly cursing the three criminals and sincerely wishing them a most speedy death. His forehead wet and his white shirt dark with sweat, the short commander of the ailer was situated at the foot of the hill near the open road to the top. Time and again he would approach the leather bucket belonging to the first squad and scoop handfuls of water from it to drink and to moisten his turban. Achieving some degree of relief, he would return to pacing back and forth on the dusty road leading to the summit, his long sword banging against his laced-up leather boot. The commander wished to set an example of endurance for his cavalrymen, but, pitying the soldiers, he allowed them to stick their lances in the ground in the shape of pyramids and drape their white cloaks over them. It was under these tents that the Syrians hid from the merciless sun. The buckets emptied quickly, and men from different squads took turns bringing water from the gully that lay towards the city, where, in the feeble shade of emaciated mulberries, a muddy stream lived out its last days in the diabolical heat. The bored horse handlers stood here as well, holding the subdued horses and trying to catch the shifting shade. The languishing of the soldiers was understandable, as were their curses directed at the criminals. Fortunately, the procurator's concerns about civil disturbances that could take place during the execution in his hated city of Yerushalayim turned out to be unjustified. And when the execution entered the fourth hour, not a single person was to be found, contrary to expectation, between the upper infantry and lower cavalry cordons. The sun scorched the crowd and chased it back to Yerushalayim. The only creatures within the sentry's lines were two dogs of unknown ownership that had somehow ended up on the hill. But even they were overcome by the heat and lay down, tongues hanging out, breathing heavily, and paying no attention to the green-backed lizards, the only things not afraid of the sun, and scurrying about amid the blistering rocks and creeping plants with large thorns. No one attempted to free the condemned, either in Yerushalayim itself, which was flooded with troops, or here on the cordoned hill, and the crowd returned to the city. The execution held absolutely nothing more of interest, while the city was already busy with preparations for the great holiday of Passover, which began in the evening. The Roman infantry, on the upper level, suffered even more than the cavalry. The only thing that Centurion Ratslayer allowed his soldiers was to remove their helmets and don white headbands moistened with water. However, they had to remain standing with spears in hand. Himself wearing an identical headband, but dry, he paced a short distance away from the group of executioners, without even removing the decorative silver lion heads from his shirt, without taking off his greaves, sword, or knife. The sun beat straight down on the centurion, unable to cause him any harm, and the lion heads were impossible to look at. The silver practically boiled in the sun, eating away at the eyes with its blinding glare. Ratslayer's disfigured face showed neither fatigue nor annoyance, and it seemed as if the giant centurion could pace like this all day, all night, and another day. In other words, as long as need be. Pace just like this, hands on heavy belt with copper medallions. Stare just like this, alternating between the posts with the condemned and the soldiers in the line. Kick the toe of his shaggy boot just like this, knocking aside the time-whitened human bones and small flint rocks that found their way under his feet. The hooded man placed himself on a three-legged stool, not far from the posts, and sat in contented immobility, occasionally poking in the sand with a twig out of boredom. It would not be entirely correct to say that there wasn't a single person left beyond the line of legionnaires. There was one, but he was simply not visible to most. Rather than staying on the side where the road was left open to the top, the most convenient location to watch the execution, he positioned himself on the northern side, where the hill was irregular rather than level and accessible, where, amid the pitfalls and gaps, a sickly fig tree tried to survive in a crevice, clinging to waterless earth, cursed by the heavens. It was under that very tree, which failed to provide even a semblance of shade, that this solitary observer, not a participant in the execution, was located, sitting on a stone from the very beginning, for the fourth hour now. Indeed, he had chosen not the best, but the worst location to witness the execution. But even he could see the posts, see the two shining spots on the centurion's chest beyond the lines. For a man who clearly wished to remain unnoticed and undisturbed by anyone, this appeared to be more than sufficient. 4 hours ago, however, at the onset of the execution, this man behaved in a strikingly different, very conspicuous manner. Perhaps this was why he had changed his behaviour and isolated himself. It was back then, when the procession was pulling through the cordon onto the summit, that he first arrived, and obviously late at that. Breathing heavily and pushing others aside, he did not walk but ran up the hill. Seeing the cordon close in front of him and everyone else, he pretended not to hear the annoyed shouts and made a naive attempt to break through the soldiers to the very spot of the execution, where the condemned men were already being taken off the cart. In return, he received a painful blow to the chest with the blunt end of a spear and jumped back from the soldiers, crying out not in pain, but in despair. He glanced at the legionnaire who struck him with hazy and utterly indifferent eyes, like a man who cannot sense physical pain. Coughing, panting, and clutching his chest, he ran around the hill, hoping to find some gap in the line on the northern side that he could slip through. But it was too late. The ring had closed, and the man, his face deformed by grief, was forced to abandon his attempts to break through to the carts where the posts had just been unloaded. These attempts would only have led to his capture, and being detained on that day was not at all a part of his plan. And so he went aside to the crevice, where it was calm and no one bothered him. Now, perched on his rock, the black-bearded man languished, his eyes watering from the sun and lack of sleep. He would sigh, opening his worn talus, transformed from blue to dirty grey by long journeys, and exposing his chest, bruised by the spear, grimy sweat running down its surface. He would raise his eyes to the sky in unbearable anguish, watching the three vultures that had long been floating in great circles high above in anticipation of the impending feast. He would peer hopelessly at the yellow earth, seeing only a half-wrecked canine skull with lizards darting around it. The man's suffering was so great that at times he would talk to himself. "Oh, what a fool I am," he muttered, swaying back and forth on the rock in heartbreaking pain and clawing at his dark chest with his nails. "A fool, a silly girl, a coward. I am no man. I am carrion." He would fall silent, hanging his head, and then revive himself with a drink of warm water from a wooden flask. He would grab at his knife, hidden on his chest under the talus, or at the piece of parchment lying before him on the stone next to a stylus and a bottle of ink. The parchment already contained some words. "Time passes as I, Matthew Levi, sit on Bald Mountain, and still there is no death. Further, the sun sets, and still no death." Now Matthew Levi picked up the sharp stylus and hopelessly wrote down the following: "God, why are you angry with him? Send him death." Having written this, he sobbed without tears and again wounded his chest with his nails. The cause of Levi's despair lay in the horrible misfortune that had befallen him and Yeshua, and also in the dire mistake that he, Levi, believed he had made. The day before yesterday, Yeshua and Levi had passed through Bethphage, near Jerusalem, where they had been guests of a certain gardener, who had taken a great liking to Yeshua's preaching. Both guests had worked in the garden all morning, helping their host, and intended to walk to Jerusalem in the evening cool. But Yeshua appeared to be in a hurry, saying he had some pressing business in the city, and left alone around noon. Here lay Matthew Levi's first mistake. Why had he let him go alone? Come evening, Matthew was not to go to Jerusalem. Some unexpected and horrible illness struck him. He was shaking, his body filled with fire, his teeth chattered, and he would demand water every other minute. He could not go anywhere. He collapsed on a horse blanket in the gardener's shed and lay there until dawn on Friday, when the ailment released Levi as suddenly as it had seized him. Though he was still weak and his legs trembled, he bid his host goodbye and headed for Jerusalem, tormented by an odd premonition of catastrophe. There, he found out that his premonition had not deceived him. The catastrophe had happened. Levi was in the crowd and heard the procurator pronounce the sentence. When the condemned were being taken to the mountain, Matthew Levi ran alongside the line of soldiers in the crowd of onlookers, trying to secretly alert Yeshua somehow that at least he, Levi, was there with him, that he had not abandoned him on the final journey, and prayed that death find Yeshua as quickly as possible. But of course Yeshua, staring far off at his destination, could not see him. And then, when the procession had moved about half a mile down the road, Matthew, who was being shoved around in the crowd right next to the line of soldiers, had a simple and brilliant idea. Immediately, in his hot temper, he showered himself with curses for not having thought of it sooner. The soldiers did not maintain a dense line. There were gaps between them. With enough dexterity and a very precise calculation, one could crouch and slip in between two legionnaires, reach the cart, and jump on top of it. Then Yeshua would be saved from suffering. A moment would be enough to strike Yeshua in the back with a knife, crying, "Yeshua, I save you and follow you. I, Matthew, your one and true disciple." And were God to bless him with another free instant, he could stab himself as well, avoiding death on the posts. However, this last notion was not very important to Levi, the former tax collector. He did not care how he would die. He only wished that Yeshua, who had not done the slightest evil to anyone in his life, would escape torture. The plan was good, but the problem was that Levi had no knife with him, nor did he have any money. Furious with himself, Levi climbed out of the crowd and ran back to the city. His inflamed head was preoccupied with the single feverish thought of how he must immediately, by any means necessary, obtain a knife in the city and catch up to the procession in time. He ran up to the gate, manoeuvring in the mob of caravans being sucked into the city, and saw the open door of a bread shop on his left. Breathing heavily after his dash down the scorching road, Levi composed himself and walked into the shop in a most stately fashion. He greeted the keeper behind the counter, asked her to get the top loaf from the shelf, preferring it to others for some reason, and then, when she turned around, silently and quickly grabbed from the counter the best thing there could be, a long bread knife sharp as a razor, and darted immediately from the shop. A few minutes later, he was back on the Jaffa Road, but the procession was nowhere to be seen. He ran. At times he had to collapse in the dust and lie there motionless to catch his breath. Thus he would lie, astounding the people heading to Yerushalayim on mule and on foot. He would lie, listening to his heart pound not only in his chest, but also in his skull and in his ears. Catching his breath, he would jump up and continue running, but his progress grew slower and slower. When he finally saw the clouds of dust raised by the long procession ahead, it was already at the foot of the hill. "Oh, God," Levi moaned, realizing that he would be late. And late he was. When the fourth hour of execution had passed, Levi's suffering reached its peak, and he flew into a rage. Rising from the stone, he threw the knife, uselessly stolen, he now thought, to the ground, crushed the flask with his foot, depriving himself of water, tore the kefir from his head, grabbed at his thin hair, and began to curse himself. He cursed himself, uttering nonsensical words, growling and spitting, denouncing his mother and father for bringing a fool into the world. Seeing that the cursing had no effect, that nothing had changed in the blistering sun, he closed his eyes, clenched his dry fists, and raised them to the sky, towards the sun that sank ever lower, lengthening the shadows as it fell into the Mediterranean Sea, and demanded an immediate miracle from God. He demanded that God immediately send Yeshua death. Opening his eyes, he discovered that the hill had not changed, except for the fact that the blazing spots on the centurion's chest had extinguished. The sun now directed its rays at the backs of the condemned men who were facing Yerushalayim. Then Levi shouted, "I curse you, God!" In a hoarse voice, he cried that he realized God's injustice and that he trusted him no longer.
"You are deaf," Levi growled, "for if you were not, you would have heard me and killed him at once."
Closing his eyes, Levi waited for fire to rain from the sky and strike him down. This did not happen, and without opening his eyelids, Levi continued to shout mocking and offensive statements at the heavens. He cried of his complete disillusionment and of the existence of other gods and religions. Yes, another god would never have allowed a man like Yeshua to burn on a post in the sun.
"I was wrong," Levi shouted, his voice almost gone. "You are a god of evil, or are your eyes completely obscured by the smoke from the temple's incense burners? Have your ears ceased to hear anything but the priests trumpeting? You are not an omnipotent god. You are a dark god. I curse you, god of thieves, their patron and their soul."
Something blew into the former tax collector's face, and something rustled under his feet. It blew again, and Levi opened his eyes and saw that, whether by force of his curses or some other cause, everything in the world had changed. The sun disappeared before reaching the sea whence it sank every evening. The storm cloud that swallowed it rose menacingly and relentlessly in the western sky, its edges already boiled with white froth, and its smoky black belly was tinted yellow. The cloud rumbled and occasionally spilled fiery threads. Pillars of dust flew along the Jaffa Road and through the barren Hinnon Valley, propelled over the pilgrims' tents by a sudden wind. Levi fell silent, trying to figure out whether the storm about to cover Yerushalayim would bring any change in the unfortunate Yeshua's fate. And at once, looking at the threads of fire slicing up the cloud, he began to beg for lightning to strike Yeshua's post. Looking in repentance at the clear sky, not yet devoured by the cloud, where the vultures were swerving to avoid the storm, Levi thought that he had been foolishly hasty with his curses. Now God would not listen to him. Levi turned his gaze towards the foot of the hill, his eyes glued to the area where the cavalry regiment had been strung out, and saw that it had changed significantly. From high up, Levi could see clearly the soldiers stirring, pulling their lances from the ground, and putting on their cloaks. He could see the horse handlers trotting towards the road, leading the black horses by their bridles. The regiment was on the move, this much was clear. Spitting and shielding his face from the dust with his arm, Levi tried to figure out what the cavalry's departure could mean. He shifted his gaze higher and made out a figure in a crimson military chlamys ascending to the place of execution. And the former tax collector's heart went cold in anticipation of the blissful end. The man ascending the mountain in the fifth hour of the criminal's suffering was a cohort commander who had galloped from Yerushalayim accompanied by an orderly. The line of soldiers parted at Ratslayer's motion, and the centurion saluted the tribune. Taking Ratslayer aside, the latter whispered something to him. The centurion saluted a second time and headed towards the group of executioners, who were sitting on the rocks at the foot of the posts. Meanwhile, the tribune approached the man sitting on the three-legged stool, who rose politely to greet the visitor. The tribune quietly said something to him as well, and they both went to the posts. They were joined by the head of the temple guard. Glancing sidelong in disgust at the dirty rags lying on the ground near the posts, rags which recently served as the criminal's clothing and had been rejected by the executioners, Ratslayer summoned two of their number and ordered,
"Follow me."
A hoarse, nonsensical ditty came from the nearest post. Hestus, who hung on it, had lost his mind towards the end of the third hour from the sun and the flies. Now he quietly sang something about grapes, swaying his turbaned head occasionally, causing the flies to rise half-heartedly from his face, and set right back down on it.
On the second post, Dismas was suffering more than the other two, because awareness had not left him. He swayed his head regularly and often, left and right, so that his ears struck his shoulders. Yeshua was more fortunate than either. In the very first hour, he began to pass out and soon lost consciousness, his head drooping in its unravelled turban. As a result, the flies and wasps had completely covered him, his face disappearing under the shifting black mass. Fat horseflies sat in his groin, on his stomach, and under his armpits, sucking on the exposed yellow body. Obeying the signs of the hooded man, one of the executioners picked up a spear, and the other brought a bucket and a sponge to the post. The first executioner raised the spear and tapped first one and then the other of Yeshua's arms, stretched out and bound to the horizontal bar of the post with ropes. The body, with protruding ribs, shuddered. The executioner passed the tip of the spear over the stomach. Then Yeshua raised his head, sending the flies buzzing up to expose the hanging man's face. Swollen from bites, eyes inflamed, it was unrecognizable. Peeling his eyelids open, Hanotzri glanced down. His eyes, usually clear, were now cloudy. "Hanotzri," said the executioner. Hanotzri moved his swollen lips and answered in the hoarse voice of a criminal. "What do you want? Why do you approach me?"
"Drink," the executioner said. And the water-soaked sponge rose to Yeshua's lips on the tip of the spear.
Joy flashed in Yeshua's eyes. He pressed against the sponge and began to absorb the moisture greedily. Dismas's voice came from the neighboring post.
"Unfair! I am the same criminal he is."
Dismas strained but could not move, his arms bound to the crossbar in three places by rings of rope. He drew in his stomach, dug his nails into the ends of the crossbar, and kept his head turned towards Yeshua's post. Hatred burned in Dismas's eyes. A cloud of dust enveloped the area. It grew quite dark. When the dust flew away, the centurion shouted, "Silence on the second post!" Dismas fell silent. Yeshua tore himself away from the sponge, and trying to make his voice sound gentle and convincing, and failing, asked the executioner hoarsely,
"Give him a drink."
It grew darker by the minute. The storm cloud filled half the sky as it headed towards Yerushalayim, saturated with black moisture and fire. Steaming white clouds flew ahead of it. A flash came right above the hill, followed by a thunderclap. The executioner removed the sponge from the spear.
"Praise the generous hegemon," he whispered solemnly, and stabbed Yeshua lightly in the heart.
The latter shuddered and whispered,
"Hegemon."
Blood ran down his stomach, the lower jaw twitched convulsively, and his head fell. At the second stroke of thunder, the executioner was giving Dismas a drink, and with the same words, "Praise the hegemon," killed him as well. Hestas, his mind gone, shrieked in fear when the executioner appeared next to him. But when the sponge touched his lips, he growled something unintelligible and sank his teeth into it. A few seconds later, his body, too, went limp as much as the ropes would allow. The hooded man followed in the footsteps of the executioner and the centurion, himself trailed by the head of the temple guard. Stopping by the first post, the hooded man looked over the bloodied Yeshua carefully, touched the man's foot with his white hand, and said to his companions,
"Dead."
The same happened by the other two posts. After this, the tribune signaled to the centurion and turned to leave the summit together with the head of the temple guard and the hooded man.
The sky was half dark, crisscrossed by lightning. Fire spurted from above, and the centurion's cry, "Raise the cordon!" drowned in thunder. The happy soldiers came running from the summit, strapping on their helmets. The darkness enveloped Yerushalayim. The downpour came suddenly, catching the sentry halfway down the hill. The water fell so fiercely that as the soldiers ran down, raging torrents already surged at their backs. The soldiers slipped and fell in the soggy clay, hurrying to the level road where the cavalry, drenched to the bone and barely visible through the wall of water, was departing for Yerushalayim. A few minutes later, only one man was left on the hill amid the smoky brew of storm, water, and fire. Shaking his conveniently stolen knife, falling from the slippery ledges, grasping at anything nearby, and occasionally crawling on his knees, he headed for the posts. He would disappear in complete darkness, only to be illuminated by flickering light a moment later. He was already up to his ankles in water when he made it to the posts. Tearing off his heavy, waterlogged talus and remaining in his shirt, he clung to Yeshua's feet. He cut the ropes on the shins, climbed onto the lower crossbar, hugging Yeshua, and freed the hands from the binds. Yeshua's wet, naked body fell on Levi and pinned him to the ground. Levi wanted to hoist it immediately onto his shoulders, but something stopped him. He left the body lying in the water, head thrown back and arms spread out, and ran to the other posts, his feet sliding apart in the clay mud. He cut the ropes on them as well, and the two bodies plunged to the ground. Several minutes later, only two bodies and three empty posts remained on the top of the hill. The water hammered and turned the corpses. Neither Levi nor Yeshua's body were on top of the hill by then.